The Bible reading today comes from the book of Genesis. Genesis chapter 32, beginning verse 6. And the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and he is coming to meet you, and there are 400 men with him." Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. He divided the people who were with him, and the flocks and the herds and the camels, into two camps, thinking, "If Esau comes to one camp and attacks it, then the camp that is left will escape." And Jacob said, "O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, O Lord who said to me, 'Return to your country and to your kindred, that I may do you good,' I am not worthy of the least of all the deeds of steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you have shown to your servant. For with only my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two camps. Please deliver me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he may come and attack me, the mothers with the children. But you said, 'I will surely do you good and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude.' The same night he arose and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 children, and crossed the ford of Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream and everything else that he had, and Jacob was left alone. And a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then he said, 'Let me go, for the day has broken.' But Jacob said, 'I will not let you go unless you bless me.' And he said to him, 'What is your name?' And he said, 'Jacob.' Then he said, 'Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed.' Then Jacob asked him, 'Please tell me your name.' But he said, 'Why is it that you ask my name?' And there he blessed him. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, saying, 'For I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered.' The sun rose upon him as he passed Penuel, limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the people of Israel do not eat the sinew of the thigh that is on the hip socket, because he touched the socket of Jacob's hip on the sinew of the thigh. Then Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau was coming, and 400 men with him. So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two female servants, and he put the servants with their children in the front, then Leah with her children and Rachel and Joseph last of all. He himself went on before them, bowing himself to the ground 7 times until he came near his brother."
Thanks, Sandra. This is one of those chapters I think I would prefer wasn't actually in the Bible, then I wouldn't have to try and work it out. I think it would be nice if we could have Murray or Dave talking about this one, and I could sit back and enjoy. Then it is moments like that that I discover I am a little bit more like Jacob than I would like to think. But why wouldn't I like to be like Jacob? I'll table that one for a moment because I think it's important and we need to come back to it. But this passage here, what are we to do with this strange story of Jacob wrestling in the night? Who is it he's wrestling with? Is it God? And if it is God, why does Jacob seem to be stronger than God is? Did it really happen to Jacob, or is it just a dream? Actually, that last one is the one that gets the funniest answers. People who write books about this sort of thing come to two conclusions. Some of them say that the story is just made up to explain that bit in verse 32 about this ancient Israelite custom of not eating this bit of the hip of animals. You know, sort of just so story, like how the elephant got its trunk. Why we Israelites don't eat the sinew on the hip. Now finish your vegetables, please, children. That kind of story. The other hot favourite for the people who write books and things is that this is an ancient myth that's been dressed up a bit. That once upon a time there was a story of Jacob having to fight a river spirit before he could cross the river, and that our Bible writers have sanitised the story a bit to get rid of rivers, river spirits, and handed it down to us as a piece of theology. We simple readers of the Bible are all hoodwinked, and it takes a university academic to see what it's really all about. And the academics invariably point to the vast number of ancient myths about people fighting river spirits in order to cross rivers. And we sort of nod learnedly as we change the channel and find something more interesting than an ABC religious affairs program. It'd be a wonderful thing, though, to be a religious academic. You know, never be answerable to anyone, to have to back up what you say. Funny thing is, first and least important, it's a bit like elementary My Dear Watson in Sherlock Holmes, or once upon a time in Grimm's fairy tales. You know, I know of two myths from all of mythology where people fight river spirits, and neither of them were trying to get across a river at the time. One was actually competing with a river spirit to marry a princess, to let that pass. Usually in myths, people sleep with river spirits, not fight them, but let that pass as well. Second, and more importantly, Jacob is quite clear in verse 30 that it's God he's been struggling with. And he is staggered by the fact, literally staggered. It's not some spook from the stream. So what do we do with this weird story? Do we go down the track that preachers go down? Do we say, this story's all about prayer? You see there in verse 9, Jacob is praying. Well, what he's doing here is wrestling with God in prayer. You know, I won't stop until you bless me. And the meaning of this is that when we pray, we must think, oh dear. But what are we to make of it? Well, put it into the context of the whole story of Jacob first, and then see how it looks. After all, look at verse 28. You have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. See, this is connected with things that have happened to Jacob before. After all, remember how Jacob's story goes. It's like going up a staircase, this story of Jacob. When Jacob dreams of his famous stairway to heaven in chapter 28, there's a stairway to heaven 4,000 years before Led Zeppelin got there. A staircase is a good picture for Jacob's life. The great high point of Jacob's life is there at the top of the stairs. In chapters 29 and 30, Jacob becomes the father of a pile of kids. And that is the great fulfillment of what God has promised to Abraham and to Isaac. And Jacob's story is a long journey up to that point. And it's a journey in space too. Jacob starts off down here in the land of Canaan, in the promised land. And the children are born way up here in Haran in Syria. Which opens questions like, why? If God has promised him the land of Canaan, why isn't he there? Why in verse 23 is he taking his family across rivers in wild places? And we know how the story starts on the bottom step, don't we? Jacob has run away from Canaan because of his hairy twin brother Esau. Now, in a world where being the eldest is terribly important, twins are a problem. Can you imagine that? Who is the eldest son? We've got twins here. What are we going to do? Esau is the eldest by a whisker. Then comes Jacob hanging on to the heel. Even to have a name like Jacob is asking for trouble. All these names that they have mean something in Hebrew, and to be Jacob is like being called swindle or cheat. Would anyone really give their kid a name like that? Well, when I was a school teacher, I used to teach a boy who was called Attila. So I suppose anything is possible. And then we have these episodes. You can imagine, you know, come on swindle, come and sit up for dinner. We have these episodes between Esau and Jacob. In chapter 25, there is the business of the lentil soup. Now, we'll actually have a go at this tonight. We'll at Sunday at 6, we'll set up that area at the back as a kind of a dining room, and we'll have a bit of lentil soup and sort of join in the story a bit. But there's the business of the lentil soup. Esau turns up hungry, and there is Jacob cooking. In what looks pretty normal, he says, "Let me eat some of this red stew, for I am famished." And Jacob, in a way that is typically Jacob, smells an advantage. "Sell me your birthright." Now, you knew people like this at school, didn't you? You ask to borrow their ruler, and they offer to rent it to you. Two chapters after that comes the famous incident where Jacob actually pretends to be his hairy brother. Isaac, the father, is old and blind. He wants to bless his eldest son before he dies, so he sends hairy Esau out hunting. Rebecca connives with her favourite son, Jacob. She cooks a goat and flavours it to be like some kind of wild game. Jacob approaches his father in a hairy disguise, and he doesn't beat about the bush. He says, "I am Esau, your firstborn. Now sit up and eat of my game, that your soul may bless me." Isaac is suspicious, but he goes ahead and blesses Jacob. Then later on, when Esau really does turn up, Esau and Isaac are both appalled at what has happened, but there is no going back. And Genesis says, "Now Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, 'The days of mourning for my father are approaching. Then I will kill my brother Jacob.'" Rebecca gets wind of this and arranges with Isaac to have Jacob sent away to Haran to find a wife. So when Jacob left Canaan, because he was trying to escape from hairy Esau, and he was trying to escape from Esau because Jacob has managed to swindle Esau out of everything that might have been his. As Esau says in chapter 27, "Is he not rightly named Jacob, for he has cheated me these two times?" Or literally, "He has Jacobed me these two times." But on his way out of Canaan, there's this weird experience that gets immortalized as Jacob's ladder. Jacob stops for the night at Bethel. He's heading up, stops at Bethel, and he sleeps in the open. And Jacob has this famous dream of a stairway going up to heaven and angels going up and down it. And in all of that, God speaks to him and makes him the same promise that he made to Abraham. God promises land, descendants, and blessing, and that through Jacob and his descendants, God will bring blessing to all the families of the earth. In addition, God promises to go with Jacob and to bring him back to the land of Canaan. Now, knowing Jacob, we might well ask, what's he done to deserve this? And the answer is, nothing. Jacob is absolutely awestruck. Now, back in the lying to Isaac to get the blessing episode, when Jacob lied about having been hunting, he attributed having a quick kill to God. He said, "The Lord your God granted me success." And we get the impression that he doesn't mind including God in any lies that he tells. But now God turns out to be really there. So Jacob does a quick backpedal and he offers God a deal. You know, in a religious movie, it would be a turning point. The sun sets. Jacob sees a vision. It turns his life around, and from now on, he will be a nice person with occasional lapses. In reality, Jacob is as much Jacob as ever. If God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear, then the Lord shall be my God, and of all that you give me, I will give a full tenth to you. A tenth, eh? God ought to be very pleased with generous terms like that. Now, after this strange dream, come the long and complex chapters that don't often get read in church. But they help us to make sense of what we have in front of us. Jacob goes from Bethel to Haran, and he finds his family. He meets his cousin Rachel by a well, and she takes him home to Uncle Laban to meet the family. Jacob stays in Haran for 20 years. He winds up married to two women and sleeping with two others, with 11 sons and a daughter as the result. And the promise that God made to give him descendants comes to fruition. But it's the process that makes the story odd. In his father-in-law Laban, Jacob meets another Jacob. I think we read it, we see Jacob and Laban, and we think, these two deserve each other. There's a strange business of Jacob's marriage. In the famous story, Jacob works for his uncle as a shepherd to earn Rachel as his wife. Well, patriarchal society and all that. But famously on the wedding night, Laban switches brides on Jacob and gives him Rachel's sister. Next morning, when the fireworks cut loose, Laban comes out with a half-baked story about local customs and the rights of the eldest daughter. He offers Jacob a deal where he can have Rachel on credit. And we wonder if Jacob has finally met his match. Not quite. Once the children are born, at the top of the staircase, God speaks to Jacob and tells him it's time to go back to Canaan. And where we had steps up on the outward journey, we have steps down on the way back. And the first step is a weird struggle with Uncle Laban, as bad as the swindle over marrying his daughters. Laban and Jacob are each trying to out-Jacob each other. Now, this is 4,000 years ago, for people whose wealth is in flocks and herds. Jacob and Laban agree, that is wages. Jacob gets to keep the spotty sheep and the spotty goats from the flock. Laban immediately removes all the spotty ones to another pasture where Jacob won't be able to find them. Jacob institutes this bizarre breeding program to try and multiply spotty animals. And the swindle back and forth goes on. So to stick to his end of the swindle, Jacob, with his large number of wives, huge number of children, and truly vast number of spotty sheep and goats, sneaks out of Haran while Laban is off at some kind of big sheep shearing do. And Jacob heads back towards Canaan. But there is a snag. 20 years ago, he swindled a homicidal brother in Canaan. Now, he is on the way back to meet him. So you can see where the staircase is heading. On the bottom step, Jacob is going to wind up facing Esau. And that's where he's heading in this chapter. He takes the initiative and sends messengers ahead. Then look at verse 6. We came to your brother Esau and he is coming to meet you, and there are 400 men with him. Jacob's reaction in verse 7, we may be able to understand when then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. He divides his family and spotty sheep and things into groups for survival. And then in verse 9, he launches into a very different prayer from the kind that he made at Bethel. Verse 10, look at him. I am not worthy of the least of all the deeds of steadfast love and all the faithfulness you have shown. Verse 11, please deliver me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau. This is full grovelling, please get me out of this mess prayer. You may find it familiar. I do. There is no doing a deal. There is no offering God a 10% cut in the proceeds here, is there? This is just crying out to God and saying, help! Then he takes other measures. When Jacob had previously swindled Esau out of goods, in the bit that we haven't got printed, from verse 13 onwards, we see him preparing huge gifts of wealth, of livestock, of servants, and sending them ahead to Esau. In fact, it looks like Jacob's return to Canaan is a mirror image of running away from it. So in a way, after Jacob's strange vision at Bethel, when he's running away from Esau, it's not all that surprising that he has another strange visionary experience when he's heading back to face Esau here. And look at these strange verses in the light of all that. When God met Jacob at Bethel on the journey out, Jacob was all alone and God made him promises. Now God has kept those promises. He's blessed Jacob, he's given Jacob children, and now Jacob is all alone again, and God meets him. But in verse 24, it looks like God is the enemy. So we think this can't possibly be right. A man comes, and for no readily apparent reason, starts wrestling with Jacob. And then again, in a mirror image of sunset at Bethel, this goes on until dawn. And we think it can't possibly be God, because in verse 25, Jacob seems to be winning. And then in verse 26, Jacob seems to force a blessing out of him. Very weird. But then look at it from another point of view. If we are used to the New Testament, then God turning up as a man shouldn't bother us too much. We are used to that with Jesus. But then this wrestling bit seems odd. Why does he do that? Well, shelve that question for a minute. Does Jacob really have the upper hand? Look at verse 25. How easily the stranger defeats Jacob when he wants to. He touched his hip socket, and his hip was put out of joint. Now, if he can do a thing like that so easily, why does he wrestle with Jacob? Look down at verse 29. Jacob's name has been swindled all his life, and that's what he's been doing with Esau, with his father, with Laban. Now God says, your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. Or literally, because you have Israel with God and with men. Because that's what the word means, to struggle or strive. See, what has Jacob been up to all these years while he's been Jacobing away? Struggling with men? Definitely. Isaac, Esau, Laban. And with God? Well, what's he done? Lied about God? Tried to bribe God? Used God as a pretext in his dealings with Laban and his wives? Called on God when he's desperate to come and dig him out of this mess? At the same time as getting whatever benefit God had promised him on the way up to Bethel. So why does God come and wrestle with him as his opponent? Because in a crude physical sense, that is like a picture of what Jacob has been up to all his life. God's giving him a dose of what he has been doing all these years. And Jacob is a crude physical man. So just to make it dead clear, God gives him a new name. And where he used to be called Swindle, he's now going to be called Struggles with God. Now, that is no compliment. Whenever the name gets used, whenever the Israelites are reminded of their ancestor's name, it is on the agenda. This is the man who received God's promises, but he struggled with God all the way. But I think the most amazing bit is just before sunrise in verse 29. Have a look at verse 29 there. And there he blessed him. All that, everything that's happened, and he blessed him. Way back at Bethel, God promised blessing. And in spite of all the Jacobness of Jacob, in spite of all the Israelness of Jacob, in spite of all Jacob's wrestling all the way up to Haran and all the way back again, he blessed him. And it comes out in very crude terms. The thing Jacob is so desperate about in verse 11. In the very next chapter, Jacob faces hairy Esau, the one he Jacobed out of everything. He faces hairy Esau and Esau's 400 men. And what happens? They have a big hug and happy families, and Jacob and Esau on terms with each other. God blessed him. In fact, God pulled his chestnuts out of the fire. And God kept the rest of his promises. Jacob's children went on to be the great ancestors of Israel. They had land, they had blessing, and when we read on to Jesus in the New Testament, through them, God brought blessing to all nations. So what do we do with this strange tale of Jacob? Two things, I think, for us. First, the way God is here. God in this story is completely unexpected, I think. It's the one thing that makes the whole story so shocking. I don't mean the way that God turns up in human form and wrestles against Jacob and sort of that makes the hairs on the back of our necks stand up. But it's who God deals with that's a bit shocking. See, what is the normal way in all the world to think about God? God rewards the good and punishes the wicked. God's interested in religious people, people who will offer him their 10%, people who will struggle and strive to the religious top. If you're straight, if you're noble, if you do good to all around you, then God will take an interest. That's the way it goes, isn't it? I do the good deeds, God then does his duty and gives me the reward. So God only ever socialises with the very best of company. Great religion, then. Everything depends on me. I have the power, I do the good, I impress God, I earn my way in. And then when I get there, I can say, look at me. I'm in, God is impressed with me, and I deserve every bit of it. But then look at God here. Back at Bethel, after Jacob has already done his bit with the lentil stew and the hairy arms, God makes his promises to Jacob. I am with you and will keep you wherever you go. Jacob is who Jacob is, but God makes his promises to him. And then in our passage, verse 28, summing up all of Jacob's life so far, you have striven with God and with men, and then he slaps a name on him that will never let him forget it. But what does God do? Verse 29, he blesses him. He looks after him. He keeps the promises. This picture of God is extraordinary. This is the God we meet in the New Testament. This is the God who justifies the ungodly in Romans. This is the God who says to the thief on the cross, today you will be with me in paradise. when he hasn't got any chance left to do any good deeds or religious things. This is the God who comes into our world to seek and to save the lost. This is an extraordinary picture of God, not rewarding the people who think they've earned it, but making promises to people who can never earn them. But do I need to know that about God? Do I need to know that about God? I think that's the second thing for us in this story of Jacob. See, of all the forefathers, Jacob, I think, is the least attractive. He lies, he cheats, he swindles, he looks after his own interests, he pleads, he grovels. And down the barrel of history, we can look at Jacob and sort of, you know. Now, there's Jacob who strives with God and with man. Oh, I wouldn't want my daughter to marry one. But here's the thing. This Jacob, he gets half the book of Genesis telling his story. This Jacob, when we read Genesis, we spend the best part of 11 chapters travelling around inside his head, or very close nearby. And while I might disapprove of everything that he does, while I might never like Jacob, I understand him better than I would like to. I'm not into soul-searching and massive introspection, but the way that Jacob takes advantage of his brother to get a benefit, I can understand that better than I would like to. The way that Jacob works up the big black lies to get what he wants, I can never believe that what he does is right. But if I'm honest with myself in the small hours, I know how that goes. The way Jacob, in mortal fear, turns to prayer to get himself out of the mess he's got himself into when there is no other option left, I would not like to try and tally up the number of times I've done that sort of thing. I think this up the stairs and down the stairs in the mirror thing, that is not the only mirror in this story of Jacob. I don't think I'm supposed to grovel on the floor and try to work out ways that I am exactly like Jacob. I'm not. But why can I understand so many of his motives? If I have the high moral ground, why do I understand Jacob's driving self-interest? Why do I understand the way he can distort the truth to get his own way? But there's the thing. If I've got the least understanding in my own head of how Jacob's head works, then a God who makes friends with the virtuous and the perfect is no good to me. Which makes the story of Jacob good news in a way. God doesn't deal on merit. He deals in grace. He makes a promise and keeps it. He gives his word and acts on it. I need to know that about God. But I need more than the story of Jacob, or I'm left with a paradox, aren't I? How can God make promises to a person like Jacob? How can God make promises to a person like me? Jacob's here at the beginning of the story, but he's not the whole story. He's just a forefather. In the end, I've got to go much further than Jacob. I've got to go to the New Testament and to Jesus. I've got to see the cross and see how one good man stands in the place of all the Jacobs of this world. I've got to see how God can offer his friendship and forgiveness without offering it to merit and perfection. I've got to see how God, through the cross, can justify the ungodly. I need the New Testament for that. If all I've got is Jacob, then it's all as mysterious as a wrestling match in the dark. But even here in Genesis, it's dead clear that if I can relate even a little bit to the way that Jacob works, then this God is the one I need. And the good news is that this God is the God of the Bible. This God is the God who saves people through Jesus. This God is the God who gives his love and his promises to people who don't deserve it. This God is the God who is there.